Welcome to Podcast on Fire, the Richard Norton interview. Well, we've already had one, but this is another one, a revisit, a fill-in-the-blanks type of time. And the very kind and talkative Richard Norton returns to go over some other aspects of his career we didn't cover in our first chat, including his computer game credits in more detail, becoming the fight choreographer on Gymkhara, more on working with Sammo Hung, working on Ghost in the Shell, and his work and role on the production of the upcoming Suicide Squad, opening in, well, it's not so much upcoming anymore, it's opening in US and UK cinemas on August 5th, but early August around the world, seemingly. So I won't bore you with too much more details. We'll get into it and let the man speak. But first, some quick contact information. And this is Podcast on Fire on the Podcast on Fire Network. We are available on podcastonfire.com. All other shows, this one focuses on Hong Kong cinema, but we got ones on Japanese cinema, Korean cinema, sleazy cinema, ninja cinema. We got audio commentaries and even bonus episodes every now and again. Email us if you have any questions or feedback, podcastonfire@googlemail.com. And if you follow the handy buttons at the top of our website, that will lead you to our Facebook presence, specifically our page. But you can also reach the discussion group from that page. So you are very welcome to join the group and let us know what you think and discuss with us. And you can also reach our Twitter, which is at Podcast on Fire, if you prefer to do it that way. Rate and subscribe to our iTunes feed. There's a button for that as well. And even leave a comment and a review over at iTunes. We would very much appreciate that. And finally, stream us on Stitcher Radio. They have a web presence, but their shows and our shows on their network, rather, they are available via the applications available on the Apple App Store and Google Play. And I write about the variety of Hong Kong and Taiwanese movies over at SoGoodReviews.com. My video hub is SleazyKVideo.com, and my Twitter handle is at SoGoodReviews. So that is me on my own for now, and let's transition over to me talking to Richard Norton. I hope you enjoy. Right on, let's get properly started then. But first of all, welcoming in Richard Norton for a part two chat, fill in the blanks kind of chat on Podcast on Fire. But regardless, it was wonderful to chat last time, and I'm looking forward to chatting with you again, Richard. So welcome back.
Yeah, thank you, Ken. Good to be back with you.
You know, we set up a theme for the last show. I started off talking of latter credits, but not movie credits of Richard's, because I was a particular type of gamer, and Richard has appeared in games. And when I say game appeared in games, kids, I'm not talking a voiceover, but Richard acted in the flesh in a couple of games, including a game I've now concluded called Tex Murphy Overseer back in 1997 or 1998. And it was when kids, again, you have to know about these things, kids. It was when games were made using video and a mixture of point-and-click adventure, puzzle-style type of gaming mixed with interactive movie segments. And Richard played the hitman Big Jim Slade, which was a wonderful supporting role. So I do have to ask you, because it kind of connects to the director of three of the games in the series and your friend Adrian Carr, who was a wonderful director based on the games. He made those games so cinematic, the better the technology got, the more sets that could be built for the games rather than all green screen. So, I mean, were you on board just because Adrian called you, or did you want to see what this script was about, if it was like worth doing a game compared to a movie? Or do you remember the process leading up to Overseer?
It definitely would have been Adrian calling me, asking me to be involved. And I've been a friend of Adrian's for, goodness me, how old am I now? Probably 40 years. So
wow.
We go way back. So, you know, anything Age involved in, if he wants any involvement from me, I'm more than happy to do that. And I look, I'm not a gamer, so it's a bit of a foreign world to me. But it was such an interesting process. And by the way, you know, that one in 97, you know, we did another one.
Indeed.
A few years back, and got to play Big Jim Slade again, slightly older version, but but that's okay. It was still just as fascinating to me. Not being a gamer and not being in their world, I'm used to the regular way of filmmaking, of course, being on a set and having, you know, sets you can move around. To be on a set that involves green screen and you're kind of told where the furniture is and where walls are and everything, and you've got to navigate yourself around, that alone makes it a very interesting and somewhat confusing process. But I really like the character. You know, I like the whole Tex Murphy character, and that, you know, that intrigued me enough. And other than the confusion of being on a green screen set, you're really still just following a script and a story, and you're acting, you know, this sort of somewhat the same as you would on a regular movie shoot.
Mm-hmm.
Adrian's very passionate. You know, he's such a passionate director and filmmaker, and it's what he loves doing. And so, again, I'm just reiterating that if he asks me to be involved in something, then more than likely I'm more than happy to do that, because it'll be something of quality. And, of course, that's important.
Yeah, he brought that cinematic style to the games. I mean, Chris Jones, who plays Tex Murphy, directed the first one himself, and he wasn't an actor, but all of a sudden turned out to be a wonderfully natural actor for that role of the noir detective in a sci-fi setting. But once Adrian got on board with Pandora Directive, I gotta tell you, Richard, like, it popped cinematically, and with Overseer, the confidence level clearly was starting to build in both his direction, I think, and Chris's acting as well. And your role is fun. It's for the player, the main segment is a big interactive movie segment where the player needs to not be killed by Big Jim Slade. So there's a lot of, like, make choices and stuff. But within all of that, you have a fight scene with Chris Jones. And I was just wondering, did they tap you to choreograph that fight scene?
Yes. No, definitely. You know, I get to choreograph it. And, you know, obviously choreography, no matter what movie it is always based on the skill of the person you're fighting. And Chris was great to work with, you know, but if they're not fighters per se, you can only choreograph, you know, as I said, what the other person's capable of doing. But it didn't need to be a ridiculous Jackie Chan type fight anyway. You know, it's got to fit the story and the character. And so it was just a lot of fun. And getting back to Chris, I really enjoyed him, because kind of what you see as Tex is pretty much the way he is. He's quite dry and, you know, understated and everything. And I think that really worked for that whole character.
He manages to log these wonderful one-liners that are not cheesy. Like, one of my favorite ones, that's like, danger is like jello. There's always room for more. So he's good at that.
Yeah, that's very much him. And then it makes it fun like that.
But that fight scene, just to conclude that, I remember it did have a nice kind of primal nature to it. So it wasn't designed as a martial arts bout or anything. It was a fight between one big guy and one smaller guy, yes. But it had a nice primal feel to it. So I thought the job well done, Richard, on stepping in and put. And indeed, you were brought back to the Tesla effect, as it was called, a game a few years ago. So was Adrian. So it was good so many cast members came back for that one from prior games. So I was glad to see, because you're part of that universe, that you're back as well. So I just started the game, not reached your portions yet, but probably soon will.
Well, let me know, because I wouldn't even know how to play the game. That's how much I know about it. So I never actually got to see myself interactively sort of portrayed. So that's pretty funny.
But let's dip into a variety of subjects not covered last time, if you will. I mean, it's a healthy and stuffed career. So last time I went over a few things, but I went back to a few odds and ends, if you will. So hopefully that will be the result, will be an informal but informative chat. Because this came about quite quickly, this interview, I didn't have a chance to watch the movie Gymkhana, but I'll notice in the credits that, other than playing the role of Zamir, you're also credited as fight choreographer, and it looks to me that this was your first big credit as that. And I was wondering what led up to that crucial behind the scenes role. Did it happen unexpectedly, or were you trying to pursue that behind the scenes work a few years into your career at that point?
No, it wasn't something I was pursuing. Look, as you probably know, Freddie Weintraub was a producer on Jim Carter, and Bob Klaus directed. And for those that are not aware, Fred and Bob were the producer and director of Enter the Dragon. So they've got a history in action. And because I know Fred quite well, having worked with him on Force 5, Fred was the producer and Bob Klaus was director of Force 5, they're aware of my action ability. So it just seemed a natural fit to ask me to help put the fights together for that. And it was interesting. Look, it could have been a lot more. You know, that I always laugh because the fight scene I do with Kurt Thomas, mm-hmm. and again, for those listening, Kurt was an Olympic gymnast. In fact, he was slated to win all sorts of gold, but it happened to be the Olympics. It was boycotted by America, whatever year that was. But Kurt being a gymnast, Fred's idea was he wanted an American-style Jackie Chan,
mm-hmm.
hence the casting of Kurt, who hadn't acted before. You know, he's a good-looking young kid and obviously very physical. The only difficult part was when you start to choreograph, it's kind of a problem a lot of people don't realize. They think if you're physical or if you do martial arts, that doing a fight scene for a movie is just going to be kind of part of the course. It's going to be quite easy, but it never is because it's a whole different medium. I mean, everything has to work for camera. It's not like doing a stage play or doing a martial arts demo or doing a gymnastics display. It's got to work for camera, as we well know, and that takes a bit of skill and it takes a bit of understanding and learning. And the big drawback with Kurt was that whereas the Hong Kong stunt guys will do those gymnastic tricks in the middle of a fight on any surface, in any location, Kurt needed to have almost like a perfect situation, meaning it almost had to be like a gymnasium. Because if you remember the fight he does in the courtyard, there's a pommel horse, which looks exactly like a pommel horse. And it was supposed to be something that was looked like it should be to tie goats to or whatever. And there was a little swing on a bar, you know, that he does with guys running down an alley. And in other words, the whole fights had to be sort of moderated to suit Kurt's ability to do his gymnastics. That was a bit hard. And the second part is, of course, he had no particular training in any sort of martial arts. So that it gets back to what I said about even working with Chris. You really have to do – your fights are only as good or can only be as good as the person you're choreographing them for, mm-hmm. or who you're fighting. And in this case, you just have to make it work for that. And you know, I look at those fights and I think, well, you know, they wouldn't stand up today in a fit because it's an 80s style of martial arts fight. It kind of worked okay for back then. It wouldn't work anymore now, but – but that's okay, you know. And even the fight that I did with Kurt, they were supposed to spend 3 days shooting that fight, and, you know, I was going to make it a big spectacle, you know, because it starts off with me almost like playing cat and mouse with Kurt because he's obviously half my size. And I had to sort of just basically beat him almost to a pulp, and then he pulls out his gymnastics and ends up coming back and winning. But the fight starts, we ended up shooting it in 3 hours rather than 3 days. And
wow.
We start off where with some leaves and you see me sort of run out of frame and somewhat that. But the reason for that was we had to try and find a little bit more sunlight to continue shooting to get it finished. And the problem with all of that, I mean, it's kind of funny, but it's not, because audiences, when they look at a film, for the most part, they would believe you have perfect conditions, perfect time to rehearse, all the time in the world to make it the best fight you can make. So they believe that that's probably the best you're capable of. And in so many cases, that's far from the truth. And in this case, it's a good example because, you know, I sort of slap him a little bit. Next minute, he's, you know, got his legs around my neck and I'm kind of finished. And I went, oh, man, that's a bit disappointing. But it's fun. I mean, it's film. What can I say, you know?
Did you get, like, a little – I know you didn't, like, do it constantly on every movie you were in, but did you get a little bit of a behind-the-scenes bug based on this movie, that this is a natural fit for me, I want to develop in this area of coordinating?
No, to be honest with you, the coordinating for me – and I know we'll get on to Mad Max and Suicide Squad and all of that. It's – I got to be – totally honest, as I always like to be, it's not that that was a career path that I chose. It's more comes out of a necessity that I realized quite early on that to get any sort of longevity in this industry, you have to be multi-talented and you have to be able to multitask. You know, I'm 66 years of age now, you know, and age is a factor in film because you're a product. You know, a lot of the action films, they want the 25-year-old, 30-year-olds. Of course, there's some older people still doing it, a la Jackie Chan, but that's almost like a Clint Eastwood is one of the few that actually gets to do even action stuff at his age. I just realized that acting would start to get a lot more scarce. So to learn how to be a second unit director, to be behind the camera, to be able to choreograph fights made a lot of sense. So again, it's not like I went, wow, this is great, I want to do this. It was more, again, out of the necessity of having longevity. And it's actually turned out to be a very good thing for me, because I got to say, as a martial artist, I've always said that I'm a martial artist first. That's been my passion my whole life. It still is. And movies was really a way just to make enough money to be able to spend more time in the dojo or the academy learning martial arts. So it was a means to an end as opposed to a passion for the actual entertainment industry, if that makes sense.
Absolutely.
I'm completely okay with the fact that the acting roles are very scarce these days, though there's still some around, of course, and that I'm still able to be involved in the industry as fully as I am by being behind the camera. And in the last few years, it's been as a fight coordinator. So that's kind of how that's come about.
Touching on that, the behind-the-scenes roles, and as they are piling up, so to say, nowadays, I mean, are you itching to yell action and cut on your own movie anytime soon? Because you have done second unit directing as well.
Yeah, no, I did 4 years of that in Lithuania, as you probably know, on a series. And I got to tell you, I learned more than I've ever learned on anything else. I mean, I didn't want to do it. My wife was the one that sort of said, no, you should do it. I said, no, that's not really what I want
to
do.
Listen to your wife, Richard.
yes, you have to. Happy wife, happy life, as they say. But so when I went, you know, spending 6 months out of the year in Vilnius in Lithuania, what an unbelievable learning process it was. You know, to be able to be putting fight scenes every week, every day, 6 days a week, see them cut together the following week because it was for television. I mean, you just learned so much. So that was invaluable. And it also was incredibly invaluable to me as an actor, too, to be behind the camera and understand that whole process. Quite enjoyable from that point of view. But, you know, when you get to the bigger movies, it's, you know, it always looks like, you know, you see behind the scenes and it always looks like it's just fun.
But it's work, probably.
Yeah, it does your head in, you know. When you get this mega fight you've got to put together with actors that maybe haven't been trained to fight, and figuring out who's going to double them and how you're going to shoot it and blah, 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 you know, can do your head in. So it's I would much rather 100% be an actor full time than being a fight coordinator. It's far easier being an actor because you basically learn your lines. You're called on the set when you're on camera, and other than that, you're in your trailer or back at your hotel. It's a cakewalk comparative to being on the set 14 hours a day doing fight coordinating or stunt coordinating. You know?
Yeah, you're probably taking on multiple roles anyway on a movie. If you're directing and writing, or directing and acting even, you gotta be ready to deal with many things during all hours of the day almost. It's not that it's what 8 hour cakewalk, as you said, or whatever. So I mean, I admire those who can take on so many roles, including a main director.
Yeah, no, and by the way, I sort of digressed a little bit from your original question about directing, but yes, I think I would like to. I think it'd be quite daunting, but, you know, I just recently was asked to direct a Chuck Norris movie that they were going to shoot here in Australia. Well, for a couple of reasons. If you shoot in Australia and you want to get the rebates, you need an Australian director and or writer and everything else. But part of the reason also was Chuck was and his brother Aaron were just so comfortable with the idea of me directing, because I've been in the business 40 years and also I've known Chuck for over 30 years. So knowing him so well, having worked with him on Walker and everything, they thought that would be a very good fit, you know, for me to direct. And I thought, wow, well, that's a scary thought. But it was also quite exciting, the idea of it, because I thought, yes, why not? I had a meeting with a very top Australian DP here who was willing to come on, and I said, look, I will need you to hold my hand during certain aspects of it. I think I understand performance, obviously choreography and all of that, but there's certain aspects of camera and setup. And he was more than happy to take on that role. So And that's also the secret. It's getting synergy on a set and getting the right crew. You know, you need a great AD and you need a great DP. Because, you know, people forget, you know, the problem with a lot of movies is that directors are very good technically. They understand framing and, you know, lighting and all of that. But there's so many of them haven't got a clue about performance.
Mm-hmm.
The last thing they focus on is performance. And to me, that's your job as a director. You know, you've got to, there's a reason they give DPs Academy Awards, and that's because they're the ones that set the light and the mood and framing. And of course, the director will give a certain direction, a type of mood he wants, and all of that. But I just think a director should really be focused on sitting there almost like old school, watching the actors perform a scene and giving them choices and everything else. But there's very few that actually understand that process. And I believe that I could bring that to the table, you know, if I was to be given a chance at directing a movie.
Indeed, because even with general spectacle and lighthearted entertainment with that is action tinted and is easy to watch, you kind of need to care, as you said, about the whole picture. It doesn't need to turn into a David Mamet play just because you focus on performance, but you still got to put your dedication to that. Indeed, I very much agree, because you don't want the audiences to tune out in the middle of it all. You'd want them there for the entire 90 minutes rather than the 20, 30 minutes of action or whatever.
Well, and here's the thing, Ken, and this is what I, you know, as you know, I just finished working on Ghost in the Shell,
mm-hmm.
training and working with Scarlett Johansson, which was just fantastic. She's such a delight. We can talk about that later. But part of the thing, and the same with Suicide Squad, you know, working with Margot Robbie and those people, is you could, like, Avengers is mainly done with doubles and they do face replacements. So the actors don't really do any of the action at all.
Mm-hmm.
And I say to them, but that's all very well, but I said, there's no fight that hasn't already been done in my mind. You've everything's been done. You can't reinvent the wheel. I said, but what you bring to it as the actor is the dramatic beats. And it used to be when I did movies, you would have drama, 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 then the drama stops, you have a fight, then the drama continues.
Yeah.
The fact that, and that worked only because fights were still kind of new and interesting, but the fact that everything's been done, you have to bring drama into the fight. And that's why we call it nonverbal dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
There has to be a story. There's got to be emotion, the coming from. Why are they fighting? Are you scared? Are you angry? You know, is it a vengeful sort of act which will dictate the choreography and everything else? And I just basically say to the actors I work with, if we can see the actor thinking in the middle of the fight, in other words, making decisions, being aware, that's gold, because now you're going to engage the audience rather than, oh, well, here's a whole lot of physical action, as good as it may be. If it doesn't have that organic sort of sense to it, I just think you switch off, because I do. I don't want to put films down. I'm not really much of a superhero, you know, hero movie nut. I don't read the comic books, so, and I understand there's an audience out there that just love that, and wouldn't matter what went off, they'd probably like it. But I watched, you know, Captain America Civil War, and I just was left cold, because I didn't care about anybody. I didn't know why and how most of the characters related to each other.
Mm-hmm.
Again, that's my ignorance for not having watched all the other movies and stuff. But the fights too, they're amazing fights. And I know, you know, the guy that did the fights, you can't fault them, but they still had no soul to me. It's still nothing new. I'm kind of sick of seeing people on wires bouncing off walls and doing flips and everything else. And I just think that to have directors and or choreographers that can understand the drama within the fight, you can make then a fight a lot more basic in its delivery, but still have an impact, because it becomes part of the character and part of the story.
And that's a wonderful point, because someone would be a creative person or a producer or an executive would almost be afraid if someone brought something new to the table, why not do this? But as you just said, you can scale it back. It doesn't need to be bigger spectacle. It needs to be character spectacle. And that doesn't cost $50 million to create in a computer. Like, you can create that physically a little bit easier. So sometimes I wish a little bit more bravery in commercial cinema would exist, and if they stopped and slowed down their thinking rather than making 10 of these movies a year. And I have a point later about the oversaturation is sort of my personal pet peeve of these things, that we get so much of this, and that's another thing. But I do like your instincts for character within all of this.
Yeah, and I having acted, you know, listen, you could say, well, the lower budget movies, it doesn't matter. It's still acting. You're still taking on a character. And I think that's helped me tremendously doing the work I'm doing now, because there's kids that can do physical stuff that I couldn't even dream of doing, mm-hmm. you know. But that's okay. You hire the doubles and you hire the kids who can do all that stuff. You know, your job, though, I've always said your job as a coordinator is to be like the conductor of an orchestra. I mean, the orchestra conductor can't play the trombone and the clarinet and the trumpet and everything else, but his job is to just make sure it's all in tune, that the song is complete, you know, and that's what I feel is most important with my role. As I said, Suicide Squad, you know, had some of the most talented stunt doubles who could do anything physically. And it's great to say to them, look, what can you come up with here? And it could be this, blah, blah, blah. And they'll come up with stuff. And your job is really to tweak it and go, wow, I love that. But could we just do this and maybe do that? But more importantly, it's to make it in line with the character. Because this is why I wouldn't be good in a super villain movie. I don't like all the tricked up stuff. It's not my thing. I'm more reality based. And Suicide Squad, at least, all the characters in Suicide Squad are basically regular people with exceptional abilities, meaning that Deadshot is just a fantastic, he's a sniper, you know, and he's just an amazing shot, but he's still just a regular earthly guy. And, you know, Captain Boomerang is still just an Aussie dude who happens to throw boomerangs and fight with them, probably like a Kali, a screamer, you know, martial arts would use them.
What a wonderfully on-the-nose name. I love that, Captain Boomerang. Like, what's his thing? Well, let me explain. That's wonderful. I like that.
Exactly. And Harley Quinn has a, you know, she originally had a big sort of like sledgehammer type thing and a baseball bat and a pistol. Mm-hmm. Other than that, she can't climb walls and do all that sort of stuff. So I love that, because again, it's about character, and accordingly, all the action they do has to be in line with that character and their accompanying sort of abilities that one could imagine. You always need to be, when you have a character do something, I like to say, well, what gives that character the license to be able to do that? Doesn't matter, we can get a stunt double in to do three flips, but you've got to ask, but how would that person know how to do that? And would they do it? And is that their skill set, or are we just kind of showing off as choreographers as far as how much we can trick something up? That to me just doesn't work. You know, I think you've just got to stay true to story and character. And I tell you who a good one that really pressed that home to me again was George Miller doing Mad Max. George is, you know, people say to me, oh, you know, did you do the fights for that one and this one and that one? I said, look, I'd love to say yes. I mean, we're all a part of it. I mean, we're just a part in a big wheel, you know, cogs in a wheel. But George's fingerprints are over every aspect of that film. And when you do a fight, you have to justify every punch, every kick, every move to George as far as why would the character do that? Why wouldn't he do this instead or whatever? And he's totally about reality as far as the character traits and what they would do. Like Tom Hardy's character, he's really an ex-cop military type dude, but he's a street fighter. You know, he's learned to fight just by learning to survive against unusual odds. He's not superhuman. So all the moves are based on that kind of those parameters. And I really enjoy that. And Tom also, Tom Hardy, there was a day he went, we'd put this whole tanker fight together. Another guy, Greg Van Bossum, of course, was a fight choreographer. But Tom started to go through it, and it took 2 hours, but he went through every beat. Why is that person over there looking that way and not at me? Why are they standing that way? Why is this weapon here? Blah, 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 blah. And it was fascinating because it just reminded me again of the detail that can be and is necessary to get the drama right in an action scene. It's not just an action scene for the sake of action. And boy, it was, you know, it was refreshing to hear and to listen to George and someone like Tom break down an action sequence. And I thought, wow, that's the art, especially these days. You just can't get away with it being anything else, I don't think, you know?
I mean, is anyone ever going to do again? I think I asked you this before, like, is anyone even going to be brave enough to attempt something like Fury Road again? Because it seemed like, it seemed dangerous. I'm sure it was safe and sound and all of that, but it was just such a different movie, not a throwback, but a different movie that I have not seen for a couple of decades, Richard.
The best description I heard of Fury Road, Mad Max Fury Road, was the Road Warrior movie, which was the second Mad Max movie. It's the Road Warrior on steroids, and that's what it was. It was pushed to the limit, and you're right what you said about it being scary, because sure, there's visual effects and everything that creates structures and arches and all that, but every stunt in that movie was a real person, a real stunt guy driving a real car, a real bike, and a real crash, and it was life-threatening every time they did it. I mean, you see these cars belting across the desert. Sure, they added vehicles in later, but we still at some stages had 80 to 100 vehicles. Well, because I was playing a character, I was in the Giga Horse, you know, with the Immortan character, Hugh Keyes Burns. So I was in the front vehicle. I was thinking the whole time, thank God, because if you're on one of vehicle number two or vehicle number 10 in the background, you couldn't see 3 feet in front of you because of the dust. And a lot of the stunties were, we harness them onto the vehicles. But if anyone fell off, the only way you'd know it is if you felt a bit of a bump while you drove over the top of them.
Jesus.
And it was that dangerous, and no question about it. I mean, every stunt was meticulously worked out and rehearsed for good reason. And Guy Norris, who's, you know, a dear friend who I always work for in these movies, he was the second unit director, stunt coordinator, and you had some other coordinators. But they're meticulous in the way they rehearse, and for good reason, because it's not visual effects. This is real. You do something even slightly wrong, somebody's going to die, you know, mm-hmm. That was the thing about, and I think that's what resonated with so many, you know, audience members with Mad Max. It was like it's throwback to the 80s, where it was real people, real stunts, and it had that organic feel that I was referring to earlier. You just felt something very real about it, and I think that's what worked.
It wasn't in my response as a viewer who grew up on more physical action and then started to grow up a little bit on, oh, the computers, what they can do, it's marvelous, and then started to realize that they're using it too much and we're getting away from the physical elements of movies. So I was happy to see that throwback, and you kind of sit there and awe, and your jaw hits the floor, like, who is allowed to do that? What movie studio said it was okay to do this in 2012 or 13? But yes.
Well, yes, and by the way, you sat there. Now, I did the whole movie. I mean, it was in Africa for nearly a year, and we watched it. When I watched it in 3D, it was like a whole different experience, but I was in awe. I was like, oh, my God, look at this thing, you know? It was an amazing experience. And by the way, you alluded to, would there be another one? Apparently, there's another two planned, but I asked the same question you do. I'm like, how do you top that? I mean, how do you one-up Fury Road? I don't know how you do it. The only way you can do it, of course, is with an amazing story, of course, which again gets back to what I'm keep saying. It's everything now got to be based on story and character. The action should almost be incidental to a good story and good characters, and that's the only way I think you'd be able to do it. And by the way, whether George, it's years out of his life to do a movie like that. The amount of planning and the detail, I don't know. It would take a tremendous amount of energy, and his passion, of course, would probably still prompt him to give it another go. But I would completely understand if he said, "You know what? Let's leave."
It's a crescendo to go out on that. It's kind of akin to dropping the mic. Like, I'll give you Fury Road, and now I'm out. Like, no one would blame George for not doing any Mad Max in the future. But all of this alludes to the fact that you're working internationally, and even earlier on in your career, I mean, and even before the movie career, of course, being a bodyguard, you travel all around the world. But, you know, did you overall enjoy that, or is that an added stress to work abroad or search for work outside of Australia and America so much? I mean, for instance, you when you did Equalizer 2000, I believe you shot in the Philippines in that quarry. I mean, that's an example. So how's that been throughout the years? Has it been enjoyable seeing the world, even if only via set sometimes, or quarry set in this case?
Yeah, no question about it. I love the Philippines. You know, I had the best time because I did so many movies there. And, you know, yeah, you sometimes I used to think I was categorized as a mountain goat because you're in these quarries running up silly sand dunes and everything else. But I got to tell you, it was so much fun. And still today, I would much rather be doing those movies than the big movies I'm doing now. Mm-hmm. And the reason being, it's just a whole different synergy. I mean, you've just got people that'll jump in on Equalizer. If you've got to move a light stand, you move it. If you've got to help catering, you'll do it. It's like everybody would throw in just to get the movie done because you had 2 and 6 months to shoot it with. You know, so it's such a collaborative process on a smaller movie. Of course, the results don't compare with the bigger budget ones, but the thing I don't like with bigger budgets is I have a saying that where your name appears on the call sheet determines how you're treated. It's a very much a pecking order of such, and I understand it. I don't like it, though. I still don't. You know, I think everybody's there equally importantly to do a job. If the guy that, you know, rigs the lights isn't there, then the film doesn't happen. The same way as the lead actor isn't there, the film doesn't happen, or if the director doesn't show up. So I would like to think that we're all equal when we're trying to collaboratively make a movie. Doesn't always happen that way. There's a lot of bad behavior on big movie sets, and that's not going to change, you know, especially certainly won't change just because I think it should. But I did enjoy the smaller budget movies, and I absolutely enjoyed the opportunity to be in so many different countries. You know, like you probably know, I was in Kazakhstan for 4 months, and good God, Kazakhstan. And it always intrigued me that I could end up in a country that I would never, ever choose to go through to under my own steam, and suddenly they fly you, they put you up, and you get to experience a whole different culture while you're getting paid for it. And sure, it's hard and it's difficult, but you can't trade those experiences for anything. I think I might have mentioned last time that, you know, when I was working in Lithuania, I just remember one day sitting with Judy, with my wife, in these beautiful Baltic forests with a whole lot of horses. We're having a little lunch break, and we're sitting there picking blueberries. I suddenly went, oh, my God. I said, first of all, how many people would ever get to experience this? And we're actually getting paid for it. We're on the other side of the world. How good is this?
Mm-hmm.
Or another time in Kazakhstan, we're on a snow-capped mountain, you know, where Genghis Khan roamed. And we spent 3 days getting visual effects shots with an old gentleman who was in his 80s and his son. They had 12 eagles, which they'd raised since chicks. And that's the way this guy lived. He used the, you know, had two of them with us then, but through an interpreter, he said that's how he lives. He said the eagles would go and hunt foxes and rabbits and bring them back. The eagle gets the meat and the guy gets the pelts and makes his fur hats and coats. And it's like he would have done 1,000 years ago. And we're up on snow-capped mountains watching this guy with his eagles. And I thought again, that just made the whole 4 months worthwhile, those 3 days, because I thought, this is a life experience you can't buy. I mean, who gets to do this, you know? So you realize how blessed you are in certain situations like that, you know, and it's basically an antithesis to when it does get very hard and long hours and everything else. But, you know, you got to take the good with the bad, because certainly beats working in a bank 9 to 5, I would think.
And it's wonderful to log those things in your memory bank and realize that you're never too old for little pieces of harmony like that. You know what I mean? That, you know, appreciating nature, appreciating people and character and the purity of that. So that's a wonderful, wonderful memory. And by the way, kudos to the production designer on Equalizer 2000, because I always say that movie co-stars The Gun. Because that's what I remember. That gun is marvelous.
And I told you, it all worked. The shotgun worked and the Armalite rifle worked.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the funny part about it. So, which is very typical in those countries. You know, I think, again, looking back, I'm thinking, how come I'm still alive? Because I'm dressed as a U.S. Army military dude in camis and everything. Often we were sort of on properties that's private, keep out, government and everything else. I'm thinking I should have been shot. And even back then, because they wouldn't know the difference. And, you know, there were the days of the NPA, which is the New People's Army, and you'd see them up in the mountains. And the reason they were so interested in us was because all the weapons we had were usually from the local military base, that you give them, you know, a few pesos or whatever it is there, you get actual weapons, you know, rifles, grenade launchers and everything. That's what you're using on the film set. So, of course, these NPA, which were supposedly communist insurgents, even though I used to think they're pretty much just down-and-out people who've been given a gun and food to eat and told to fight for whatever cause. But whatever it was, you know, it's, I think, God, talk about the guerrilla school of filmmaking. You know, we'd even some days going on Equalizer and those, some of those Filipino films, each day we'd take a different route to the set because of the risk of being ambushed by brigands or NPA or whatever. And in fact, one day we had an old army truck that used to bring a lot of the weapons, film equipment. He got to the set late, and he was basically these NPA again, as I said, that stands for New People's Army, which again were sort of, again, loosely called communist insurgents or whatever, but they saw the truck and they thought it was a military truck, and they got close enough and realized it was a film truck, and they basically said to the driver, you were like seconds away from being blown off the road with a grenade launcher.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, so you go, wow. But exciting, I mean, because, you know, I'm young, you know. You're
awesome.
You're indestructible, you know. It's only when you look back, you go, God, what the hell was I thinking?
Oh, wow. Well, we can't not mention working with Samos. And one of the movies we didn't mention last time was Sammo Hung's Millionaire's Express, which, you know, you're probably your biggest Hong Kong movie in scope and certainly cast-wise, because everyone was in it, including you guys, you and Cynthia, and a variety of Westerners, I think. So I know it was hard to get a script or to get clued into story context on smaller movies, but was it even harder on this big one? Like, did you only know, I'm a bandit, I have an X amount of action to do, fantastic, I'm with Sammo again.
You say script, to which I say, script? What script?
Yep.
Because they literally write the script each day as they go on those sorts of movies, those Hong Kong movies back then anyway. I don't know whether it's changed.
Probably a little bit changed. The industry is a little bit more rigorous nowadays.
But back then, first of all, even if there was a bit of script, it was always in Cantonese or Mandarin. And, you know, I was often the only sort of guailo or white person on the set, you know, and you had no idea what you were going to shoot until you're pretty much in front of camera, and you were almost just asked to imitate. Sammo would sort of act out what expression he wanted, and you pretty much just had to imitate what he was doing. Mm-hmm. That's how little knowledge or pre-knowledge you had on script and story and everything else. I mean, all the fights and everything, see, the difference with Western movies is all the fights are choreographed, they're pre-vised, you film them, you get it improved, you shoot a master, and then you do coverage, you do over shoulder and inserts. But with those movies like Millionaire's Express, it's made up as you go. So you're shown X amount of moves, they turn the camera on, and you rehearse in front of camera, and you might do 30, 40 takes until you kind of get it right, and then they'll move on and figure out what the next moves are going to be.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way it was. So in some ways that is incredibly difficult because you don't know what to expect. You can't prepare like dialogue, and you certainly can't prepare your fight moves. But in another way, it's also quite freeing because they leave themselves open to be able to take the story as far as the action goes in whatever direction they want to take it in, based on that edit they do quickly that night. And that's quite freeing.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense? It's almost improv. You know, it's like an improv rather than a totally scripted thing, because a Western movie is, again, as I was saying, you would do a master, and that you're locked into that master. You know, you would then cover that master fight, and it very seldom changes. I mean, it might change a little bit due to the director wanting a slightly different move, but pretty much you're locked into it, totally different in Hong Kong. And like I said, at least you go, okay, well, I've just got to be in really good shape and my skill set is whatever it is, and the rest is just up to whatever they want on the day, and you just, again, do it over and over and over till you get it. The other frustrating part about that used to be that you couldn't change anything. I mean, I'm a natural left-hander, so I'm a southpaw. I can obviously do things right-sided, but I would be more comfortable southpaw, but it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what you want to do. You just got to do what the Hong Kong choreographers want you to do, and if it takes you half a day or a day to do it, then that's what it'll take, you know, because there's no overtime, no unions, no stunt adjustments. So hence being on the set 18 hours a day when the fight stuff starts, and I'm talking 7 days a week. It's quite nuts.
And yet it all becomes extremely coherent fight-wise, but also in terms of the movie, Millionaire's Express, it's a joyously fun movie. It finds time to display the comedic talents of everyone involved. I mean, it's a big cast, but also the action talent of all involved. And, you know, the banner names, including you, Cynthia Rothrock, no one is underused. That's the thing. It's such a big movie, and yet Salma manages to squeeze them all in there and give them their sort of logical shot action-wise. Like, it's not like a 30-second Richard Norton fight or anything. It's a big, impactful thing. And same for Cynthia and same with everyone else. It's a joyously fun movie. So if you get a chance to revisit it, Richard, do that, because you'll have a ball.
I must do that. It's been a while. But by the way, hats off to Sammo Hung. I mean, he's still, I've said it before and I'll say it again, he's the most talented action director I've ever worked with. I mean, that guy can put a fight together with anyone, with anything, in any location, and his sense of comedy is second to none. And by the way, as you well know, those movies are about their action. They're not about story, you know. As Jackie said, nobody's interested in the drama. That's changed. I'm kind of talking about back then. They knew the kids that watched those movies wanted to see a half-hour fight scene. It mm-hmm. didn't matter how unbelievable it was. It didn't matter. It was all about the athleticism and the ability of the people performing the fights. And there's nobody better than Sammo. And I, by the way, I say that's what it was back then, because when it all changed, you know, I saw the movie, I forget what it was, in the nightclub that Sammo Hung did with Donnie Yen. And
that would be SPL.
Yeah, fantastic. And I just watched, I remember a shot where he's smoking a cigar and they do a slow track in with a camera, and he was just totally still. And it was riveting, and I thought, wow, that was just such a good scene. Or even Jackie Chan in the Karate Kid movie did. I was just blown away with his performance, which, by the way, is very not what they did in Hong Kong way back.
Underplayed.
I mean, that was all, you know, everything was exaggerated and overdone, but the underplaying and the subtlety of those performances much, much later from people like Sammo and Jackie is just hats off to them. So I guess what I'm saying is what they did back then was because that was the style of movie and that was the expectation of the audience and the fans. Now it's of course changed, but all in this place, you know. It's a bit like I'm talking about 80s. I watched some of the movies I did in the 80s and I'm like, oh my God, this is like kindergarten stuff. It wouldn't hold up today in a fit, you know, but that's okay, you know. It's like when there used to be point karate tournaments were the only thing you did, and suddenly it became kickboxing and then Muay Thai. You do whatever it is that the time dictates and what the environment dictates, and that's what worked back then, and everything of course keeps evolving, you know.
Very much so. And speaking of Sammo, and nowadays with movies being drama centered and action centered, I personally know he's a good actor, and he's been in tons of movies where his dramatic range have been showcased, but I do look forward to, and if you haven't heard of it, do make a note of it, his return to directing The Bodyguard, or My Beloved Bodyguard, which seems to be less about action and more about drama, which I heard were akin to disappointment for some reviewers who were expecting the same old hard-hitting Sammo Hung action. But if I hear that Sammo's back acting, then I'm in, because I know he's a wonderful actor, and he can underplay it very, very well. So hopefully that reaches your horns in some shape or form, either.
I remember reading an article about that film, and I must have a look at it, because as I said, I love Sammo. I'm just such a total Sammo Hung fan. You know, he's the best.
But before we move on to some of the more expected chat, if you will, Bean, about the Suicide Squad as we're closing in on its premiere, you did hint at it. But what is the nature of your work on the live-action remake or adaptation of Ghost in the Shell? Because you did post a photo of yourself and Scarlett Johansson, so something is official by this point, correct?
Ghost in the Shell, I was basically hired to train Scarlett.
Okay.
That was my job. Very different for me, which made it a very enjoyable shoot because it wasn't a normal slog of having to put together every fight. So, look, it started off that I ended up going to New York. I was supposed to spend 10 days with Scarlett in New York. And the job was really what I would do with any actor before a film is just to give her the tools that may be required in the type of action that would be choreographed at a later date and that she would have to perform in the actual movie. So I was just training her in boxing and footwork and a little bit of weapons work, took her to a gun range so she could get her skill set up on how to handle firearms and everything and be totally believable and tactical. So I did that there, and then nicely she wanted me to work with her in LA. We spent another month there. That was supposed to be the end of it. And then she, again, so nicely insisted I come to New Zealand and stay with her for the shoot and keep training her and look after her choreography and on-camera work. And
wow.
Yeah, so, I was thrilled because she was a delight. But, you know, we had the choreographer is Tim Wong. He's a friend who worked a bit on Mad Max. He was the – because most of the crew were New Zealanders because in New Zealand they don't like to hire SAG actors. It costs them too much money. So they're a bit reticent to bring someone like me over anyway, but it was just nicely due to Scarlett putting a little bit of pressure on them that she really wanted me to be there because my job is to just give a bit of comfort to know so Scarlett knows there's somebody specifically looking after her and that she looks good and has the skill set necessary to do the fights because, again, the push was from my boss, Guy Norris, was that we really wanted Scarlett to do all of her own action.
Mm-hmm.
And we achieved that. I mean, mission accomplished in that she does 98% of her own fights, which is fantastic. And part of that is due to the fact that, again, the character in Ghost in the Shell is not superhuman. She's cyborg, but so she has extra abilities. But for all intents and purposes, she's just an amazingly tactically skilled fighter and thinker and everything else. So it meant the fights could be within the realm of possibility for her. In other words, she's not flying around the room and doing triple somersaults a la Avengers character or something. So it just worked exceptionally well. We formed a really, really nice friendship. And again, I kept saying to her, and I really mean it, I said that the level of excellence that she expects of herself is what makes all of that possible because she's got a fantastic work ethic. Absolutely wants to be the best she can be with everything she does, whether it's acting or, in this case, doing the fight scenes as well. And so she was just a joy. I mean, as a martial arts instructor, I don't have a lot of time for people that aren't that interested in learning.
Yeah.
But when you get somebody that is that committed like she was, then shit, that makes my job easy. So, you know, it was a great experience. But again, there were other, you know, coordinators and Tim Wong was a fight coordinator, but I was there again specifically to look after her. And tough gig, right?
that's inspiring in both directions. Like you're inspired by her inspired by you, and that creates the creativity rolling that way. So I'm glad to hear. And it sounds also like they're adhering to. I've never read the manga. I'm a big fan of the anime, and the way you describe her character is adheres to what you see action-wise in anime. Definitely, she is not flying about the place at all. She is athletic, but indeed a good tactical police officer or beat cyborg. Yeah.
Yes, totally. And yeah, they've kept very true to that. I mean, obviously, I can't tell you the story, even though you probably know it. But just again, yes, her everything's believable. I mean, that's the best way I can put it. You don't look at it and go, well, oh, hang on. Well, how would she do that? Mm-hmm. And that's what I like about those sorts of movies. I mean, Rupert Sanders, who's the director, was great in keeping it very true from that point of view, you know, keeping it true to character and true to story, which again is like I was talking about George and some of the other people I've worked with, same with David Ayer with Suicide Squad.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, David was the same. He said, I'm not making a superhero movie. This is regular people with exceptional skills, so we want it reality-based as far as what they're able to do and what the audience see them doing. I said, well, that's perfect.
And before we move on to Suicide Squad, like I'm not here to start like debating all of the Ghost in the Shell casting decisions and all of that, because I don't know. I'm not educated enough. But the thing I'm going to plant in listeners' minds here is I don't think anyone knows if this is a remake of the movie or an adaptation of the manga. It might be. They might be going back to the well that way, and hopefully that's kind of what I personally want. I'm not asking you to share in the details, but I would love for them to just go back to the manga and extract something else, something that is recognizably Ghost in the Shell, but extract things that might not have been on screen before, whether in the two movies or the TV series. So I'm looking at it with a keen eye, and in case I don't like it, I always have the anime. Like I'm not a debater as such. Like it's all about movies, man. There's no reason to get heated about different opinions of it. And I know for a fact they're probably not gonna make the movie, because the movie is difficult. The anime is pretty dense. It's very philosophical and very talky. So I think they're going to make it a little bit more general audience friendly, because for all intents and purposes, the Ghost in the Shell anime is more for the art house crowd. It really is. I mean, it has action, yes, but it is more for the art house crowd, I think.
Yeah, well, look, all I can say is that I believe that what will make this work, as opposed to some of the other movies you're referring to, is that it's character-based. I mean, you're going to understand that there is a story, there are characters, there is a character arc, there is a journey, there's a resolution, and you can't ask for more than that. And that gets back to, as I said, there's action there, but it's incidental to a really good story.
Indeed, and the anime was indeed a very complex character journey, very existential, and it requires your focus, definitely. But I'm a big fan of it and its director, Mamoru Oshii. So we'll see what happens. If it comes out 2016 or 17, I'm not sure, but I'll keep an eye out. And I'm glad you got that the ball keeps rolling for you, Richard, because we talked about you got Mad Max, and you get Suicide Squad based on that. You got this further like boost professionally, and I think that's quite deserved through this hard work. But this was, as far as I know, a comic book adaptation production, but as you said, it's more rooted in that way, and that's why I, based on trailers for Suicide Squad, because I'm not very much into the Avengers Spider-Mans either, but for me, Richard, I have no idea who these characters are, and that makes me more interested. It's new. For once, there's something new. It's not another Captain America and another Spider-Man, and it looks like darkly comical fun as well. And but anyway, what's your spontaneous thoughts on the experience looking back on it? Because it's a good year since you've finished your work on it.
Yeah, no, I'm so excited. I mean, I'm so happy. There's so much positive buzz about Suicide Squad. The trailer just got an amazing reaction at Comic-Con and, you know, online and everything. And again, why I like it is for the same reason I'm saying over and over again, I sound like a broken record, but there's actual real characters in there. There's a story arc. You get to know the characters. It's not just action for the sake of action. And obviously having such a talented director that's also the writer in David Ayer. Mm-hmm. I mean, anyone saw Fury or saw End of Watch, you know, with his other movie, The LA Cop, just phenomenal movies. So such good hands. And again, he wanted everything based in reality and based on character. And, you know, Margot Robbie's going to knock people dead. She's just going to be fantastic in it. Will Smith, I mean, God, I'm such a fan of Will's. You know, he talk about a team player and just wanting everybody on that film to have just an amazing experience, not just make a movie. I mean, the guy's just fantastic. He's friendly. He would say hello to everyone of the crew, shake hands with everybody, so approachable. And he was just a dream to work with, and so physically talented, as was Margot, as was Jai Courtney, you know, of course, who's playing Captain Boomerang. Jai's obviously another Aussie, and he was just fantastic. So it was just a great experience. You know, you had a new Karen Fukuhara, who was playing Katana. she got cast at the last minute. You know, she's obviously Japanese, and she had a little bit of scored school. We worked a lot with the katana, and even that was based on, like, very much keeping it authentic as far as the sword work went, and she did an amazing job. So what can I say? It was just, you know, what an amazing cast.
What can we expect, like, without giving anything away? Like, is it stunt heavy, or even to an extent featuring some kind of, that makes sense for this story, fight choreography, or what can you tell us about that?
Not much.
There it is.
Nice try, Ken. Yeah. Look, it's. I wouldn't say it's stunt heavy. I would say it's story and character heavy. You know, that's the best all I can really say. And I just think it's exactly what you said. It's going to be very refreshing. You know, it is dark. You know, there's just some dark comedy in there. But, of course, there's some serious action. I think people are going to just love Jared Leto as Joker. You know, I think they'll either hate it or they'll like it, you know, because what a tough call, you know, to have to carry on after someone like a Jack Nicholson plays it or a Heath Ledger. And I think Jared's just going to knock people's socks off with his commitment to the role as Joker. And I can't wait, you know, and there's only a couple more months anyway, and we'll all get to see.
Listeners and the internet should also learn to, for once, I mean, they're never going to learn this, that to wait until the damn movie comes out, and then we'll start discussing its pros and cons rather than base it on an image.
It's a bit like trying to discuss the next Apple phone or Apple computer. Nobody knows, you know. Wait until it's released, and then you'll know everything, because it's all hearsay. I mean, everything's so kept under wraps for good reason, you know. And, that's the case with this. I just think I'm just excited about it. But obviously, as I said, I can't tell you anything else about it except the wonderful people, wonderful director, and a great experience for me. And, you know, as a fight coordinator, I mean, also, as I said before, what made it good for my work is that I had some fantastic stunt doubles, so, so talented. And that's why, you know, for people to say, oh, did you choreograph all the fights? I mean, no one person does any of this stuff. It's such a collaborative process that the doubles and their input is invaluable. I mean, I get to tweak stuff and everything. And again, we just form a great team with great synergy. And the end result is what it's all about. It's all about what ends up on screen. I'm not a person that believes in it has to be my idea. If somebody's got a good idea, I want to hear it. And if we can do it, if it's my idea, my credit stays the same. If it's your idea and it looks great, the credit stays the same. But we all look good. You know, the movie's a success. We hopefully do a sequel or whatever, and we all get to work together again. That's the way I look at it.
Well, it is indeed. Like, I'm not saying it because you're here, but there was something there, as I said, in the trailer. And I normally don't get sold on trailers, but there was something there where, even as someone who read just one, you know, Batman comic or whatever in his life, I felt all of this to me was so new, but also sort of refreshingly approachable. Because if you drop out of all those other universes, it's hard to keep up. But this seems so standalone, and you can jump into it. And if you translate a sense of fun in 3 minutes, I think you're on the right path for the full feature. It looks to have promise. And whoever picked Ballroom Blitz for the trailer, like,
yeah,
wow. Okay, that sets the mood.
Yeah.
So there it is. Finally, Richard, a silly observation maybe, but this is what I get stuck on and develop an interest in as I watch movies from back then and now. I don't think I've seen you do anything other than your own accent in films, and therefore certain scripts have been tailored to actually establish you as a character that's from Australia, whether in Overseer, where they do state Big Jim Slade is from Australia, or Rage and Honor. So I think it's wonderful that no fuss has been made about that, because your accent is hardly impenetrable. You know, how has that gone? Has no one tried to force an American accent on you, or did you have clout enough to say, like, nah, I'm going to keep my accent, just write it into a script?
Look, if you can justify and use it, it's a lot easier for everybody. I mean, I don't get me wrong, I've auditioned for a lot of roles in Americans and as an American bombed out, but do I care that much? Not really. Look, if I was that passionate about being an actor, I would have done like so many Aussie actors that are just slaying the world of film right now, like Chris Hemsworth and all these sorts of people. They've got impeccable American accents. Why? Because they're as passionate about that aspect as I am about my martial arts. So they're willing to do the courses, do the classes, have the dialogue coaches and everything to get those skills. It's just not that important to me is all I can really say. I don't have a very strong Australian accent. If you heard the average Aussie next to me, I mean, Australians think I sound American, whereas, of course, it's not in America, you know. But I can kind of neutralize my accent should I choose to, and I would, given the right role. But again, it would take the same amount of, you know, dedication as training for a fight scene. It's just how much work are you prepared to do, and it's obviously doable. Again, because it's been proved by so many Australian actors just playing American roles and again doing them impeccably and seamlessly.
It's good to hear though, because I'm glad that there's no indeed fuss being made about it. That they just let the audience, they trust audiences with the fact that we have multiple types of characters from different counters, and that's all fine. And just watch and have fun, and watch Rage and Honor, and play Overseer, and don't care about that. And you're not gonna need subtitles.
Ken, you hit it on the head. This is a multinational world. I mean, goodness me, Australia's got every nationality on its own, same as America does. You know, they're born on immigrants and everything. There's accents everywhere. It just started with American films being all Europe would see, American episodic, so people got used to hearing an American accent. Like in some countries, Robert De Niro's voice was dubbed with a local accent, but you know, made him almost, but that's okay if you've never heard Robert De Niro actually speak in his native tongue. If you have, then it's very bizarre, you know. But, you know, you talked about Mad Max, the very first Mad Max, Mel Gibson's voice was dubbed with an American accent. That wasn't even his voice. Yet he was born in New York, for those who know. He's about 4 years old when he came to Australia. But he had an Aussie accent. But, of course, after the success and stardom, they wouldn't dare dub his accent. But the first one, yes, they dubbed him with an American accent because that's what was perceived that you needed to do in order to sell a movie on the international market. It had to sound American. But thankfully, a lot of that's changing so much. I mean, you're getting Russian bad guys, Ukrainian bad guys, all sorts of baddies with accents. And why not? Why not? Why can't an Australian be living in America or Kazakhstan or Thailand or the Philippines? Why is that so strange? Providing you're understandable. I mean, the biggest problem is if I was saying to, yeah, g'day, mate, how you going? You know, what'd you do today? You all right? You know, I understand that because a lot of Europeans and even Americans were like, well, I don't even know what the hell you just said. Bit like a very Cockney English accent. As long as, though, you can enunciate and you're understandable, then it should be quite okay, I believe, without a whole long-winded justification on screen about why this person's sounding that way with an accent.
Yeah, well, they did naturally in their movies like a Raging Honor, just a line or two, and then we're off into the adventure, so to say. So it's all good.
Yeah.
So rational thinking coming from those filmmakers, so well done. I don't have anything else left, but I do wish you all the best, you know, leading up to the Suicide Squad release. I don't know how active you're going to be in its promotion, but regardless, like, I really hope your work is appreciated and singled out, and that the audiences really have fun with this, and that the creative ball keeps rolling for you, Richard. I really hope that continues to work for you.
No, thank you, Ken. I appreciate that. And listen, the old saying, it ain't over till it's over. I mean, I would be lying if I wouldn't have said a few years ago, oh, gee, maybe this is it for me. And suddenly, as you said, Mad Max happens and Suicide Squad now goes in the shell. There's another couple of really good projects in the works right now, which I won't go into, but it's very exciting time. You know, energy makes energy. So,
yeah.
Hey, there's still a few years left in the old horse, in the old war horse, what can I say?
hope to see more. And it is a little bit inspiring to me because to see these different chapters that are so versatile go into these chapters that we're talking about now, that's inspiring and actually very cool as well. But and the products that you help create, they speak for themselves, obviously. So Mad Max was such a eye opener for me. So I got faith in you, buddy.
Thank you, Ken. I appreciate it, my friend.
So that is it. What a kind, kind man. A very inspiring, level-headed man, too. The way he tackles the industry with a good, realistic attitude. I wish him all the best, as I said, and thank you to Richard Norton for taking the time out to chat. Suicide Squad, which Richard served as fight coordinator on, opens in US and UK cinemas on August 5th, and around the world a tiny bit earlier even, in some territories like one day or two earlier. So check it out if it looks good to you. And that is this interview put to bed. So thank you everybody for listening, and I hope you enjoyed. And this is me, Kennedy, almost signing off. Just some quick contact information before we go. And this has been Podcast on Fire on the Podcast on Fire network. Our website is podcastonfire.com, where you'll find all our different shows, including bonus episodes. If you have any questions or feedback, let us know on the following address: podcastonfire@googlemail.com. At the top of our website, there's links to our social media, such as Facebook, Twitter. You can reach our iTunes feed, which you can subscribe to and leave a rating and a comment on. You can reach Stitcher Radio, where you stream our shows online, but you can do that on the application or via the application available on the Apple App Store and Google Play. I write about a variety of Hong Kong and Taiwanese movies over at SoGoodReviews.com. My video hub with spoken audio video reviews is SleazyKVideo.com, and my Twitter handle is @SoGoodReviews. So again, thank you everybody for listening. Thank you, Richard Norton, for taking the time to chat with us. Hope you enjoyed, and see you next time.